Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Alison Brokaw. She's a behavioral ecologist with a PhD in ecology and evolutionary biology from Texas A&M. She studied wildlife in many places around the world, including Mexico, Belize, Panama, Argentina, and Tanzania. She's the author of an extraordinary book titled The Weird and Wonderful World of Bats, Demystifying These Often Misunderstood Creatures. Welcome to the Exchange, Dr. Brokaw.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I want to offer a word of congratulations, but also a word of caution. First, congratulations on writing such an extraordinary book. It's really easy to read, well-structured, for easy navigation, and it's deeply informative. But I must also offer a word of caution. Your photographer is amazing. These up-close and stunningly personal visuals with so many varieties of bats, well, that's the stuff of nightmares. I mean, these pictures really leap off the page unexpectedly. How did you decide how to structure this book, and how were these images captured?
So in terms of structuring the book, like you mentioned, my background is in behavior, and I've also always been really interested in sensory behavior, so how animals are using their sense of smell, their sense of hearing, their vision. And so I really wanted to kind of structure it as sort of, what is it like to be a bat? What are all the ways that bats experience the world? And how is it similar or different from the way that we humans experience the world? And then I wanted to point out some of the really fascinating social behaviors, and then sort of wrap up with kind of the why should we care about how bats experience the world and what is it that they are contributing to our environment. So that was kind of the arc that I was aiming for in terms of the writing. And then as far as many of the photos, I was incredibly lucky. Several of my colleagues, Dr. Brock Fenton, who is a professor emeritus in Ontario, and then Bryce Sewell, who is a bat consultant in the United States, they both donated some of their fantastic photography. And I actually am not completely sure how they are able to capture such amazing images. I know it involves a lot of remote triggers and being in the right place at the right time, but I'm incredibly grateful for their contribution to this book because they do really pop on the page, absolutely.
They definitely do. Fantastic is the right word. I mean, I've never seen bats up close, and then I turn the page and it's right there. Oh, my word. So let's take a step back and learn a little bit more about you. Not many kids grow up with an interest in studying bats. So tell me about your childhood. Where'd you grow up?
So I grew up in eastern Pennsylvania, surrounded by fields and forests. I grew up in a fairly rural area and kind of always knew I wanted to study animals. I liked being outside. I liked, you know, looking at animals, and pretty early on decided I wanted to be a zoologist. And we would see bats flying around the fields by my parents' house, especially in the summertime, and that was always really fun. But it wasn't really until I got to college and I was taking a outreach class where we had to develop a project on some topic of our choosing. And I chose bats because I thought they sounded interesting and it would be fun to learn about them. And as I was going through my research to do this project, I just realized just how cool bats were and how much we still didn't know. And so it was really around then that I decided that I wanted to study bats, and that's what I sought out when I was looking for grad schools.
See, I know you're pretty special. You used the word fun twice and then cool in reference to bats. So let's walk through your book. You welcome into the world with a picture. You're holding a bat. What are you holding?
Yeah, I believe it is that is a spectral bat, the Vampyrum spectrum, and it is the largest bat in the Western Hemisphere. They are very cool. I was very lucky to get to handle one, and they are one of the examples of some of the carnivorous bats that exist.
Oh, we're going to get into that. I learned so much more about bats than I ever knew or ever thought I'd ever want to know. But that threw me for a loop. Okay, so we're going to get to that. But let's kind of go in order of the book, because like I said, you laid this book out very, very well. So let's start with origins. You say bats live all over the world, even in unexpected places like the Arctic Circle. Tell me more.
Yeah, so one of the really special things about bats, they are the world's only mammals capable of true flight. And because they're able to fly, it's meant that they've been able to disperse to a broad range of different habitats, different places. There are many islands that you can go to around the world where a bat will be the only native mammal, potentially besides humans. And then, yeah, we even see bat activity, usually during the summertime, understandably, but we do see bat activity all the way even up above the Arctic Circle, even when they're experiencing nearly 24 hours of daylight. Some bats still find a way.
Well, how do they survive in such frigid temperatures?
So they're generally not there during the wintertime. So most of the Arctic activity we see of bats is just during the summer. So it's not as cold. And one of the really cool things about bats, I know I've been using cool and fun a lot, but something that I do talk about quite a bit in the book is their ability to hibernate and to modulate their body temperatures. So they have a physiological trick called torpor, where they can lower their body temperatures, kind of put the system into sort of neutral, and that helps them save energy. So if there are periods of time where it's colder or where there's not as much food availability, say it's been, you know, you have a week or two of a lot of rain and hunting conditions aren't great, bats can kind of reduce their metabolism, reduce their temperatures to sort of save some of that energy until situation is better.
Okay, so let's be clear that bats do not live in the Antarctic.
They do not. That is the one place we don't see them.
My guest is Alison Brokaw. She's a behavioral ecologist with a PhD in ecology and evolutionary biology from Texas A&M. And she's the author of The Weird and Wonderful World of Bats, Demystifying These Often Misunderstood Creatures. So Dr. Brokaw, talk about the chapter on scent. And also, why'd you choose to put me so up close and personal with a giant fruit-eating bat when I turned the page?
Yes. So we often think about bats as being primarily driven by their sense of hearing. So many bats use echolocation to get around. But one of the things that I became really interested in during my PhD was how bats might be using their sense of smell to navigate the world around them. And I realized it was something we didn't know as much about. So that's actually very much what a lot of my research focused on. And I know you mentioned being confronted with this fruit bat. I think they're quite cute. they kind of look like, to me, they're like little teddy bears with just a funky nose.
My word, you sound like my producer. She loved it.
So the fruit bats and the nectar feeding bats seem to use their sense of smell to help them discriminate food. So kind of the same way that, you know, we might sniff the leftovers in our fridge to make sure that it's still good, bats will use their sense of smell to figure out if fruit is ripe, if it's overripe, or if it is not ripe yet, to make decisions about what they're going to eat. And they can also use smell to make decisions about preferences. So some bats prefer to eat figs over different types of fruits. And so they will choose their favorite based on the sense of smell.
So can bats see?
They can see, yeah. So yeah, the saying blind as a bat is actually not really true. All bats are capable of seeing. Exactly how well they see depends a lot on the specific species and the adaptations that they have. So many of the insect-eating bats, while they can see, they can discriminate light and dark, and they use light cues to help them know when it's time to go hunting or to help them find the exit to the cave. They're not particularly good at spotting small insects flying around in the dark.
They use echolocation.
They're about as good at that as we are.
Right. They use echolocation, right?
Yeah. So they, instead of using vision, they're relying primarily on echolocation. So using sound, which is great because it doesn't matter how bright it is outside. Sound is always going to be helpful.
Okay. So let's talk about the one thing about bats that everyone, I think, is afraid of: their bite. Have you ever been bitten by a bat?
I have not, actually. When handling bats, well, first I was, you know, trained by other experienced biologists to how to know how to best hold a bat to minimize the chances of being bitten. And then I also always wear protective equipment, so gloves, usually leather gloves, and then actually an additional layer of like nitrile or rubber gloves. And bats are generally not able to bite through those layers.
So I didn't know that. Well, I guess I should have known this, but I didn't realize that bats have these tongues that they use to click. Tell me about that.
Yeah. Yeah. So that is only one specific group of bats. So that is the Egyptian fruit-eating bats, which are found in the Middle East and parts of Africa. So I will back up and say that while many bats use echolocation, there is a whole group of bats that do not. So all the flying foxes, the really big fruit bats that we often think of in tropical regions, those guys, they don't use echolocation, with this weird exception for these Egyptian fruit bats that sort of independently developed this ability to use their tongue as a mechanism for creating sound waves that they can then use to try to navigate. And it's actually very similar to, if you've ever heard of stories of humans who have learned to echolocate, humans are also using tongue clicking. That's the mechanism that we use if we learn to echolocate. The rest of the bats are using their larynx, which their voice box. So it's more like them screaming when they're making their echolocation noise than it is clicking the tongue.
Yeah, I much prefer the clicking versus the screaming.
Well, the good news is we can't hear the screaming because it's all above human hearing range. So.
Oh, well, that's nice. You said some bats are carnivores. What do they eat?
So the carnivorous bats, we know of some species that eat fish. There's a species in Central America, particularly in Panama, that specializes on eating frogs. And they're really cool because they learn the frog calls and they can tell the difference between the frog calls of poisonous and non-poisonous frogs. So they know which ones to pick.
Stop. There's no way.
Yeah. Yeah. There's way.
Wow. Okay. So they're using the sounds that the non-poisonous frogs make, and the poisonous frogs make a different sound and they know the difference.
Yep. Yeah. And this particular species of bat, it's the fringe-lipped bat, named because they have these little warty chins that have like a fringe, I guess, if you're being creative. And yeah, in addition to echolocating, they passively listen for the sound of their prey. So they are actually using frog mating calls to help the bat know where the frog is so they can come in and grab it.
So that's amazing. That's almost as amazing. Well, it's probably as amazing as the bats that can fish, which totally surprised me.
Yeah, the fishing bats are very cool. So they are using echolocation as well, and they are able to use echolocation to discriminate ripples on the surface of water, so they kind of know where to scoop. They have these long, impressively large feet, which also help them kind of act as, you know, a little trawl that they can drag through the water to scoop up fish and other small aquatic organisms.
Okay, let's hold it right there. We need to take a quick break. My guest is Alison Brokaw. She's a behavioral ecologist with a PhD in ecology and evolutionary biology from Texas A&M. And she's the author of The Weird and Wonderful World of Bats, Demystifying These Often Misunderstood Creatures. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on JPR. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Alison Brokaw. She's a behavioral ecologist with a PhD in ecology and evolutionary biology from Texas A&M. And she's the author of The Weird and Wonderful World of Bats, Demystifying These Often Misunderstood Creatures. So, Dr. Brokaw, before the break, we were talking about bats that are carnivorous, bats that can fish, and now I see that bats can walk. What do I do if I see a bat walking on the ground?
Well, the good news is that if you are in the United States, you are probably not going to see a bat walking on the ground, because the only bats that we know of that are fairly good at moving around on the ground are the vampire bats, which are found only in Central and South America, and the New Zealand short-tailed bats, which are only found in New Zealand. So most other bats, if they end up on the ground, they can sort of shimmy their way around and get themselves back to a bush or a tree so they can get themselves back up in the air. But they don't like being on the ground very much.
How did they end up on the ground?
There can be many reasons, particularly in sort of North America. Bats can get blown off course, blown onto the ground through extreme weather, so storms or high winds. Bats, when they are young and learning to fly, they are clumsy, the same way that when humans were learning to walk, we are falling down a lot. Baby bats have to kind of go through a similar process where they're not good at it on the first try, and they might end up on the ground if they calculate it wrong. But yeah, the vampire bats and the New Zealand short-tailed bats are unusual in the sense that they will spend quite a bit of time on the ground, and that is their what they've been adapted to eat. So in the case of the short-tailed bat, they are insectivores. They do feed on insects, and they will capture them out of the air, but they also like to feed on these special flowers that are found also only in New Zealand, the wood rose. And they are a major pollinator for this ground flower. And it's thought that because New Zealand doesn't have or didn't have native predators, that the bats just were able to take advantage of these ground resources and have some cool adaptations that make it easier for them to move around on the ground. Yep. And then with the vampire bats, they do drink blood. They are named correctly. There's only three species of vampire bats. And the way that they feed, particularly the common vampire bat, which feeds primarily on the blood of large mammals, they've adapted to feed on large livestock, so things like cows and horses. They actually approach from the ground. So they don't fly straight onto the animal. They usually fly to the ground and then crawl up while the animal is sleeping. And it's thought that not only that makes their approach stealthier, but if the animal wakes up or moves its hoof or its foot, a cow is many, many, many times larger than a little vampire bat. And so being able to walk or run lets them get out of the way quickly so they don't accidentally get stepped on or something while they are hunting.
Oh, my word. Not only are they vampires, but now they're ninjas. They can sneak up on you.
Yeah, they're very fun to watch. I recommend your listeners look up. There's some cool research where people have, what I talk about in the book, researchers were training vampire bats to walk on treadmills. And so you get a really good look at sort of how the bat moves. And it is quite interesting.
These scientists are getting bored. So I really got kind of caught up with the vampire bats, I have to admit. Actually, it was their sharing rituals. Talk more about that.
So vampire bats are really fascinating because they do participate in this sort of cooperative behavior. And part of that is due to their diet. So blood is not particularly high in nutrition, and it is full of a lot of water. So vampire bats have to feed every night in order to get enough energy that they need to make it through the next day. So if they miss a meal, that can be really, really devastating for that individual. And what has happened is in these groups of vampire bats, these females, they all know each other. They always are roosting together. So if a vampire bat misses a meal, one of its roostmates will actually regurgitate some of their blood meal into the mouth of the starving bat. and it just helps make that bat make it to the next night so that it can feed. And what's really cool about this is that they can keep track of these relationships. So there's a little bit of like, hey, I helped you last night and I didn't find any food tonight. And so a vampire bat that was helped will then reciprocate that cooperative behavior back to its fellow roostmate. So, and these relationships can last a long time, over years. So yeah, it's a really cool system for looking at how cooperative behavior and altruism can evolve in a wild animal that isn't a human.
Yeah, it sounds like a little karma there. So talk about sharing the air. Bats fly in these swarms. How do they do that?
The simple answer to that is that they're not always that good at it. So unlike, these flocks of maybe starlings or birds that we sometimes think of where they, as the birds are moving, they're, right, these like really beautiful, smooth movements and the whole group is moving together. Bats don't do that. They are much clumsier. So yeah, in some of these areas where you have these really large colonies of bats, like thousands to millions of bats who are all trying to leave a cave at the exact same time, they do run into each other a little bit. So the other big concern there is if you're using sound to get around and to be able to tell how far away the bat in front of you is, but the bat next to you is also using sound, it can make for a really complicated acoustic space. So you can imagine being at like a cocktail party or just an event where lots of people are talking. And right, how do we handle that? You have to be able to lean in, get closer. So one of the way bats solve that problem is they reduce their echolocation. So they can either drop specific pieces of the echolocation call, so sort of skip a pulse or two. Some bats will adjust their frequency. And that's actually something that humans will do as well. If we're in a crowded place that's really loud, we'll lower or raise the frequency of our voice to be better heard over the background. So bats will do something similar. All that just to kind of deal with, yeah, it being a loud space when they're all together.
It seems like they're going through a lot of work and they're on the edge of starvation all the time.
Just the vampire bats are that extreme. Other bats, they still need to eat every day the same way we do, but it's not quite as extreme.
My guest is Alison Brokaw. She's a behavioral ecologist with a PhD in ecology and evolutionary biology from Texas A&M. And she's the author of The Weird and Wonderful World of Bats, Demystifying These Often Misunderstood Creatures. So, Dr. Brokaw, how do these bats decide on a home, and how do they navigate getting back to it?
Oh, gosh. So the home that a bat chooses or uses depends a lot on the species. So many bats around the world use caves, which is probably what most people are most familiar with thinking about bats. Right, the bat cave. But many bats are also roosting in trees. Some bats create their own little leaf tent by chewing certain areas of like a big broad palm leaf to fold it over to make themselves a little tent. One of my favorites are the bats in Costa Rica and Panama, where the males actually chew out space in termite mounds to create a roost. And they do that as a way to attract females. So they put in a lot of carpentry work to create this roost space. So yeah, they're as diverse and varied as bats are. They are just as varied in the places that they live in terms of where they're roosting. Yeah, we are still figuring out exactly how bats are able to travel these long distances and what cues they are using. If they're migrating, if they're moving long distances between seasons, we suspect that they are using maybe celestial cues, so things like star position or the angle of the sun as it's setting might be cues that bats are using.
That's amazing. I thought their eyesight was very, very limited, so to see the stars, that would be amazing.
Yeah, it really depends.
How many species of bats are there?
There are 1,487 species of bats currently described by science.
That we know of.
And that number will probably go up in the next 6 months.
So they're always discovering new species.
Yeah, either discovering or just re-describing. So there's quite a few species that they look incredibly similar, so for a long time they may have been categorized as the same species, but as we learn more about their behavior, we have better genetic tools we start to realize that, oh, no, actually, these two species are actually quite different, and so are different species. We're constantly learning new things about bats.
Well, you're studying them so long and so hard that you've begun to even watch them when they go to the bathroom. And I was surprised to find that there's a difference between a bat toilet and a toilet bat.
Yeah. So bats are always surprising us, I suppose, is the way to think of that. So what you're referring to with the toilet bats are bats have been observed roosting in pit latrines, particularly throughout parts of Africa, like that hole in the ground. Bats will take advantage of that as a roosting spot. Nice and safe. There's no predators. And then the bat toilet is a really fun, what we call a mutualism between the bat and this species of pitcher plant. So mutualism where both species are benefiting. So the bat gets a nice, safe place to live by roosting on the inside of these pitcher plants. Pitcher plants are carnivorous plants, so they are usually feeding on small insects that fall to the bottom and then get digested. But by letting the bat roost in them, these plants basically are getting free, pre-digested insect bits in the form of bat poop. And that actually gives them a really important source of nutrients like nitrogen.
Okay.
With less work.
Okay, so the bat gets a home.
Yep.
And the plant gets to eat the bat poop.
Yep.
It's a nice trade-off. You mentioned predators. Who preys on bats?
Pretty much any predator that can get its hands on bats will eat them. Some of the most common animals that we see preying on bats are owls. Certain other birds of prey, so hawks and falcons, will hang out outside of big bat caves, where they know thousands of bats are going to be coming out. Other animals, so snakes will snack on bats if they can access them.
That bat other has to be on the ground for a while if a snake's going to get it.
Actually, snakes will sometimes hang out at the entrances of roosts as well, the same way that the hawks do. We talked about the carnivorous bats, so there are bats that eat other bats.
Oh. This is crazy. Okay.
Yeah.
We have 1 minute left, but let's get into the babies. What happens when bats have babies?
So bats, they have live births, so they are mammals, and they usually give birth to only one or two pups at a time. So baby bats are called pups. And then depending on the species, the mothers will either leave the pups in the roost, so in the cave with all the other recently born pups, but some bats will actually carry their pups around with them while they are out foraging or flying around. They fly with them, sort of clinging to their chest, sort of similar to like the baby swaddles that we see humans using.
And bats are a keystone species, right?
Yeah. So bats play a really important role in our environment, doing a bunch of different tasks. So they are insect control by going out and eating insects. The fruit bats are helping disperse seeds of fruit plants into new areas. And the nectar feeding bats play a really important role as pollinators for quite a few different types of plants, including many that humans use and rely on commercially.
Okay, well, we're going to have to leave it there. I really appreciate you joining the exchange, Dr. Brokaw.
Thank you so much for having me. As you can tell, I love talking about bats. So,
well, I learned a lot. My guest was Allison Brokaw. She's a behavioral ecologist with a PhD in ecology and evolutionary biology from Texas A&M. And she's the author of The Weird and Wonderful World of Bats, Demystifying These Often Misunderstood Creatures. I'm Mike Green.